Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Musk-Hawain. President Biden's Build Back Better social spending package is stalled in the U.S. Senate, and with it, policies that would impact young children across the country. Among them, universal pre-K and the renewal of the enhanced child tax credit. But people who work with young children say there's no time to wait. Child care and pre-K programs are in crisis for a host of reasons, and the COVID-19 pandemic has only made matters worse. This hour, we take a closer look at why child care in America isn't working and what needs to be done to meet the needs of our youngest and most vulnerable. Our guests are Mai Miksic, Early Childhood Education Policy Director of Children First, an organization that advocates for quality health care, child care, public education, and family stability. Damaris Alvarado Rodriguez is Executive Director of Children's Playhouse, which runs two child care centers in South Philadelphia. And Dr. Stephen Barnett is Director of the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. Welcome to you all. And Damaris, let me begin with you as the Executive Director of two child care centers. What are the challenges that you're dealing with, especially since the onset of the pandemic? What are you seeing on the ground?
I'm seeing a lot of staffing shortages, huge turnover in staffing. It's really difficult to get the staff that we need in order to service the families that we have. We're closing a lot more classrooms. We're not able to keep classrooms open. We had to shut down one classroom. We couldn't even open the classroom. So we have folks and families in our waiting list waiting for us to get teachers, you know, on board so that way we can reopen those classrooms. In addition to that, we had to close down our school-age program where prior to the pandemic, we used to service school-age out of school
aftercare programs.
And now this year, unfortunately, we weren't able to open up those classrooms and so, turn those families away.
So numbers-wise, what does that look like when you compare when you're kind of at full staff and you've got all of the children there and what you're dealing with right now? What's the change?
So prior to the pandemic, we used to service typically about 258 families and students. Up to today's date, we're servicing about 179 families.
So you've had to actually just shut down classrooms because you don't have teachers, and you don't have teachers because they're leaving. How do you see the teacher shortage?
Some of the teachers are leaving because they're stressed. There's a lot of mental health needs now that we're seeing, more now than in the typical school year prior to the pandemic. Teachers are also going through their own traumas at home, you know, through the pandemic and stuff that's just going on. So I'm seeing a lot of teachers leaving because of that. It's just too much for them this year to handle. And the staffing shortages is also adding an additional, you know, trauma, an additional hardship for them as well. So we're seeing that a lot more.
And there's also a ratio that you have to maintain,
yes.
Correct? I mean, you can't have, you know, one teacher with 15 children.
Right. So it is one teacher to every 10 for preschool. And one teacher through every four in infants, and for young toddlers, 1 to 5, and the older toddlers is 1 to 6.
Yeah.
So we try to, in our centers, we try to keep those ratios really low. But typically, prior to the pandemic, we used to have 1 to, you know, in an infant room, 1 to 3, right? So we would have typically 3 teachers in an infant room. Now we stop taking additional infants, so we're capping the infants because of the teacher shortages. Yeah. We just can't support it. We just can't support it because of the lack of staff that we have.
Mai Miksic, we are seeing labor shortages in all kinds of areas this year. What has that looked like more broadly in the child care industry based on what Damaris just described? Mm-hmm. Is that what you're seeing statewide as well?
It is, yeah. Our statewide child care advocacy campaign did a survey back in August of child care programs across the state. And out of 1,100 programs, 92% said they were experiencing staff shortages. And that led to 26,000 kids being on a wait list. So that's a lot more kids that could be served if those programs were fully staffed.
Wow. And you are, as I understand it, a new mom, so you've got some personal experience with this.
I do, yeah. I have a four-month-old as well. So he was born in July, and I started looking for care back in April, which, you know, this is what I do for a living, is try to understand these policies. So I knew that looking in April, it was already a little late, but I called six programs, and only one program had an opening, and it wasn't until November that it'd be open. Wow. And so I had to find care earlier than I would have liked to. So it's very real for me, you know, just in my professional life, but also personal.
What did you wind up doing?
Well, my husband and I went back a little earlier than I wanted to. And so my husband and I juggled back and forth, and we had a lot of help from my mother-in-law. We just made do with what we could. And eventually what we had to do was enter into a nanny share because that was what was available to us. Yeah. So
it's kind of a patchwork system of care with everybody pitching in.
Yeah, and that's true for all parents throughout this pandemic. When schools shut down, when childcare centers had to shut down, parents had to make do with what they had.
Stephen Barnett, you've been listening to our conversation, and I wonder how this is resonating with you, if this is what you're seeing as you look across the United States at the state of child care. Is this sounding familiar to you?
Oh, absolutely. Just for 3 and 4-year-olds from 2019 to 2020, a million children fell out of early care and education.
A million children.
A million.
And was that, I mean, what were the reasons for that? COVID,
well,
affordability?
This is a combination. It is mostly COVID. We already had a problem that for low and middle income families, less than half the 3 and 4-year-olds were in programs. So that's less than 4 million out of the 8 million. And then with COVID, we lost another million.
Wow. And so now, you know, as we've been talking about President Biden's Build Back Better plan, and there are certainly provisions in there for, you know, universal pre-K, for early childhood education, what exactly would the Build Back Better plan do to get more of those children into preschool?
Well, it does several things, and they're all interconnected. On the child care side, for kids birth to 5, it makes good, affordable child care available to every family, starting with those up to the state median income, and then gradually raising the income level. But that starts with half of all families. And then over the first 3 years, it ramps that up. And that keeps ramping up beyond the first 3 years to families at 2.5 times the state median income. And their provisions to both make it more affordable and increase the quality as well as expand access. On the pre-K side, it puts the nation on a path to universal high quality preschool education for every 3 and 4-year-old. These are truly transformative for children and their development and the long-term future of their academic, social, and economic success, for families and their current economic status, and for the workforce in these programs who currently are just ridiculously underpaid.
So, Stephen, you've said a lot there, and I think we need to unpack several of those things. But one of the things that comes to mind is what you said about the importance of early childhood education and what that does for a child later on. And I know that you've been involved in research with this. What are the benefits for young children of being in a high-quality pre-K program?
Well, the first 5 years set the foundation for later learning, development, and success. Or perhaps we should say, build the root system. And so high-quality preschool programs, which I think need to be both at ages 3 and 4, not just a 4-year-old program, they boost children's cognition, language, social and emotional development, even their physical development. The roots of adult health problems, whether it's diabetes or heart disease, are often in early childhood. The roots of the achievement gap that we worry about at the end of high school, half that gap is there when children walk through the kindergarten door. So high-quality preschool programs, and I'll take as an example ours in the state of New Jersey, increases achievement, decreases school failure. This is going to increase high school graduation, college attendance, and lifetime earnings.
So, Stephen, I'm curious, is there, you talked about the long-lasting effects of that. Are there, though, potential disruptors? If a child goes to a high-quality pre-K program, are there things that can happen to sort of derail that progress along the way for some of them?
Oh, absolutely. Preschool is not magic. Every year matters. The years before preschool matters. The years after preschool matters. We have to provide strong supports for learning and development for children and families every year. And that's why strong public schools are important as well as strong preschools and childcare.
Let me take a moment and invite our audience to join in the conversation. We are talking about the issues that the country is facing as it relates to childcare right now, and also about the plans in Build Back Better, President Biden's social spending plan, which is currently stalled in the Senate, and what all of that might mean for families across the country. Perhaps you find yourself in that situation. Perhaps you've got very young children in a child care setting, and you've sort of been on that roller coaster since COVID began. Or you've got questions for our guests. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or you can call us at 888-477-9499. We have a comment here from Mike, who says, "We used to do a daycare program with my boys that required parents to pitch in as an assistant one time a week. It was a great model, and it brought down the cost for families." We have just about 35 seconds or so, but Damaris, I want to ask you about that idea of parents pitching in.
We have a lot of families in our program that want to pitch in. Our family partnerships are really strong. However, through COVID, that's remotely impossible. We want to also keep our children safe and try not to expose them to too many people. So, unfortunately, that's a model that we couldn't use. Prior to COVID, we used to use that model, and it works amazingly. Like, we love our families and our centers. However, you know, through these times, I just don't think that's safe, and we want to make sure we keep our schools, communities safe.
Yeah. Much more to talk about as we discuss the crisis in childcare in America when Radio Times comes right back. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the crisis in childcare in America, impacted heavily by the COVID-19 pandemic. Teachers are quitting, salaries are low, children and families are struggling with all of it, and President Biden's Build Back Better plan has some provisions in it to spend a lot of money to build out the child care infrastructure in America. The problem at the moment is that that plan is stalled in the Senate. We've been talking with a trio of guests about the state of child care in America and what needs to be done to make it more accessible and affordable. If you're just joining us, our guests are Mai Miksic. She is the Early Childhood Education Policy Director of Children First, which is an organization that advocates for quality health care, child care, public education, and family stability. We're also talking with Damaris Alvarado Rodriguez, who is executive director of Children's Playhouse, which runs two child care centers in South Philadelphia. And also with us is Dr. Stephen Barnett. He is the director of the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. And of course, we invite you to add your voice to the conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And let me start with this question from Mary, who says, can someone define what high quality child care looks like? Stephen, you have used that term, high quality child care, so I'll start with you, and then perhaps our other guests might want to weigh in as well. But what do we mean when we say high quality?
When we say high quality, the core of that is providing rich early learning experiences that support the child's learning and development. And the essential element of that is interactions with a highly qualified teacher, one-on-one and in small groups, interactions with other children that are supported by the teacher, and interactions with the environment, with materials, outdoors, again. And to do that well, a teacher has to be inside the head of every child to understand what is it that this child needs to make the next steps of progress in each area of learning and development. And what the teacher needs to do to support the child to make that happen.
And Damaris, I noticed you nodding along as Stephen was talking about that. You are the executive director of an organization that runs two child care centers. What does high quality child care look like to you?
High quality child care looks like having teachers that are invested in their children and understand the curriculum, the content, teaching to fidelity, meeting the child where the child is at, right? Keeping children safe in a nurturing and fostering environment. That's high quality.
How difficult is it to find teachers who can provide that, especially during the pandemic?
It's been pretty difficult, kind of like finding a needle in a haystack kind of thing. But we do have, and we're blessed to have some teachers in our facility that have been with us for quite some time. So they become mentors to the new teachers. So that's a really great model that we're using in our facility.
Stephen Barnett mentioned just before the break the costs of childcare and also the salaries of teachers. The costs are high, the salaries are low. I want to read just a few numbers to you all to sort of see how they resonate, but this comes from Spotlight PA, which is an independent newsroom. It's powered by the Philadelphia Inquirer, and it's in partnership with Penn Live and a host of other media across the state. But here's what they tell us as of November. The average annual cost of child care for an infant in Pennsylvania was about $12,000 in 2019, pre-pandemic. For a four-year-old, it was about $10,000. So $12,000, $10,000. By comparison, in-state college tuition in Pennsylvania averages about $7,700, significantly less. That, of course, is not including room and board, et cetera. Another number that was interesting was that the median hourly wage for preschool teachers in 2019 was about $14 an hour. For child care workers, it was about $10 an hour. Damaris, do those numbers sound about right to you?
I don't know where those numbers are coming from, but in our organizations, those numbers, it's about $15,000 for an infant and about maybe $12,000 to $13,000 for toddlers. Our preschool programs, thank God, are free. So, you know, we're partners with the School District of Philadelphia. We provide Head Start, pre-K counts, and we also partners with the Office of the Mayor's Office of Education. So we also provide PHL pre-K. So our goal was to provide free preschool services as well. But we were fortunate enough also to have infant toddler contracted slots, and that's free infant toddler care for families that qualify.
My Mixit, I want to ask you about this, because regardless of your level of income, that's a lot of money. If you've got to come up with potentially $12,000 for infant care, $10,000 for slightly older children, what kinds of resources are available for families who have economic challenges and might not be able to afford that kind of child care?
So the resources that are available right now for families is very limited. It's limited to families making very little money. So for families at 100% of the federal poverty line or lower, they're eligible for Head Start. That's a federal program for 3 and 4 year olds. Child care subsidies serves families up to 200% of federal poverty line. Mm-hmm. And then pre-K counts serves families up to 300% of federal poverty line. But that's why what's in Build Back Better is so important. In Build Back Better, costs for families making up to 250% of the state median income by 2027 would be capped at 7% of their annual income.
7%. So, yeah. And you mentioned the federal poverty line. What is that currently? What's that number?
Steve might know this better than me. I think it's about $24,000 for a family of four. It's very low. It's not. The median income in Pennsylvania, I think, is like $65,000.
Yeah. Stephen Barnett, does that sound about right to you, the federal poverty line number?
Yes, that's about right.
Yeah. So you really have to make very, very, very little money in order to qualify. Do you see, Damaris, you know, families who maybe are just a tiny bit over the edge and don't qualify? I mean, what's your experience been with that?
All the time. That's something that it just frustrates us. We have families that make $2 over the income guideline, and they just can't access these services.
Mm-hmm. For $2?
For $2, yeah.
We've actually heard of families that have turned down raises that they've gotten at work because they knew that it would make them ineligible for their subsidies.
Stephen Barnett, one of the things that I was reading as I was preparing for this was that the Build Back Better plan, among other things, would make quality child care accessible to something like 6 million additional children. If that is the case, what is required for the infrastructure to accommodate all those extra children, not just the physical infrastructure, but the human infrastructure, at a time when there are shortages of everything?
Well, the workforce is really the key to this, and we will have to have very strong workforce development. The good news is there are a lot of preschool teachers out there, a lot of people who've been prepared as preschool teachers and left the field. And if we provide adequate compensation and strong supports for teachers to get four-year college degrees, to get specialized higher education, to improve their capabilities as preschool teachers, we can do this. And the field wants to do it. But, of course, it's not worth for any individual to invest in this if they're going to make $14 an hour. And so these all fit together. You provide enough money, you provide adequate supports and resources for the higher education, we can have the workforce. It will take time. We won't get there overnight. But by the time this bill gets to year six, we'll be very far on the path. And without something like this, we will not have universal access to preschool until the next century.
Mm. Stephen, there's a question here from Dale, which is a, kind of a follow-up to what you just talked about. And Dale asks, what training or education is required for child care and pre-K teachers and aides?
Currently, it's all over the map. It depends, literally, it depends on where you live. The qualifications are vastly different. And so in some states, if you're in a state-funded preschool program, whether you're in a private provider or a public school, you have to have a four-year college degree and specialized training in early childhood. In some other states, I'll take Florida as an example, if you have a high school diploma and some experience caring for a child who was not a blood relative, you're qualified. Well, this is a huge range. And the range is, I would say, almost as large in child care. And the reason it's not as large is because there's no state that requires child care teachers to have a four-year degree.
No state requires that?
None.
Wow. Maya Miksic, you wanted to add something to that.
I just wanted to add that in the state of Pennsylvania, in the Pre-K Counts program, lead teachers are required to have a bachelor's degree.
So, with a certification.
With a certification, yes.
But Stephen, it begs the question, you know, why there is such a disparity in what the requirements are, given the importance that you just described of high-quality preschool. Why there's such a wide disparity in terms of the qualifications. And I guess the larger question really is, why do we place such little value on early childhood education?
I think there are two reasons. One is people still don't really grasp how complex and difficult it is to provide high-quality early education. It's not just like being a parent. Having a classroom full of kids. And I think if, you know, one of the few silver linings of the pandemic, and the pandemic is so awful, I almost even hate to call it a silver lining, is that I think people have come to understand better how difficult it is to be an early childhood caregiver or teacher. And so maybe we're getting a stronger grasp on that, but still too many people think if you've been a babysitter, you can be a teacher. They really don't understand the difficulty, the complexity, the stress of the job. And the other is money. As you've said earlier, it's expensive, and high quality is more expensive. And so New Jersey's high-quality program, $15,000 per child for preschool per year. Florida spends $2,400.
So again, it varies widely, all depending, just like the qualifications, it varies widely depending on where you are, it sounds like.
And the real reluctance to have fully qualified teachers is not wanting to pay for it. And that's why Build Back Better is such a dramatic change in how we would care and for and educate our children birth to five.
Maya Miksic, I want to ask you about the child care tax credit, because it was temporarily increased earlier this year as part of the American Rescue Plan. Explain how it currently works and who benefits from it. What is the tax credit?
So the tax credit is going to be expanded under Build Back Better for an additional year. What it does is it gives families with children under the age of six $300 a month, and then for kids older than six $250 a month. And this is typically it would be fully refundable on their tax form, on their tax filings. What's been really a big deal with this child tax credit is that it's been paid up front for this first half of the year. And so families have been getting checks every month for their kids. And it's been a really big game changer for them. Parents are reporting that they are able to buy groceries, they're able to buy clothes for their kids. It's making a really big dent in child poverty.
And if I understand it right, I think yesterday or the day before, the last checks for this year would have gone out. Mm-hmm. What happens if this is not renewed for next year? Does it go back to the original amount or does it go away?
It goes back to the original amount. So it would not be fully refundable the same way that it is now.
Yeah. And what would that mean for families who are really have come to rely on that added income?
I mean, it would mean they'd have to take a step back. They'd have to find a way to make do with what they have. It would be really tragic. I mean, this has been a really big crutch for families.
Yeah. Damaris, at your child care centers, you serve a lot of refugee and immigrant families. What would this mean for them if the child care tax credit, the enhanced version, is not renewed?
You know, as Maya was saying, that relying on what they have and step back, I think for most of our families, that's not an option. So I was just thinking about ways and already thinking about ways I can bring foods and meals to them as we have been doing, right, and providing them those extra resources needed for them to be able to, I guess, get through these difficult times.
So tell me more about that. You're providing meals for families?
Yes, we provided meals, diapers, wipes, formulas, coats, shoes, anything that the families basically need, immigration services. Anything that the families described needing, we usually provide it.
So it sounds like you're providing way more than childcare.
We are. We actually hired a family advocate, social work component, to our facility, and he actually works with the families in meeting that, you know, providing them with any resources or that we can get our hands on. So, yeah.
And I imagine, Mai, that what Damaris is describing about being much more than a child care center, that's probably being played out across Pennsylvania and across the country.
Absolutely. I was just thinking that as Damaris was talking. I mean, her centers are very special, but child care centers are certainly doing a lot more than just caring for kids. They are pillars of communities. They provide more than care. They provide physical resources like diapers and food, but also a sense of community and you know, they're part of the neighborhoods.
Yeah. Damaris?
In addition to that, we became kind of like little health people and nurses in our facility, because now we have to make sure that our students, if they have like any COVID-like symptoms, you know, to make sure that we're watching and monitoring that, testing our teachers, you know, to make sure that they're in staff on a weekly basis to make sure that there's no COVID and so on and so forth. So that's in addition to the many hats we wear now. So, yeah, we do a lot.
It's a whole other layer of stuff that's added on top of the regular responsibilities.
Yes.
So much to talk about as we discuss the crisis in child care in America, and hopes are fading that President Biden's Build Back Better plan will be passed at least before the end of this year. Much more when we come back on Radio Times. We're talking about child care. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about child care in America and the challenges that families and teachers and staff members and children themselves have been up against, particularly since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. There are teacher shortages, the costs of quality child care are high, salaries for teachers and aides are low, and everyone is waiting to see what's going to happen with the Build Back Better plan, which provides a great deal of money to help early childhood education, but it is currently stalled in the Senate. As we discuss that, we've got a trio of guests with us who are helping us to understand it better. Mai Miksic is here. She is the Early Childhood Education Policy Director of Children First. Damaris Alvarado Rodriguez is Executive Director of Children's Playhouse, which runs two child care centers in South Philadelphia. And Dr. Stephen Barnett is Director of the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. We invite invite you to add your voice as well. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and of course, you can always call us at 888-477-9499. We have a comment here from Carrie who says, I pulled my child out of childcare because I was worried about COVID. I was working from home and tried to juggle both, but it was so overwhelming. I have so much appreciation for what teachers do. I'm going to let you respond to that, Damaris, because that is your life every day.
Thank you, Carrie. Thank you. It is difficult. It's difficult, you know, and my teachers do it so gracefully, if that's a word for it, how to describe it. They're always, you know, happy playing with the children, you know, really trying to meet the children. I have a really amazing staff. So,
and Damaris, we talked a little while ago, you mentioned early on about some of the struggles that the teachers themselves are having with COVID, with their own issues around all of this. But we're also hearing that children are struggling in terms of their mental health, and not just the high school kids,
yes,
but the youngest children. There's a lot of acting out. What are you seeing at your centers?
There is a lot more social emotional needs seen in the classrooms. We've invested in purchasing and delivering social emotional curriculums to really support the teachers. We're providing positive behavior intervention strategies in the classroom to try to support these students. We're just loving them much more and more and trying to really remember, you know, that they were not in school last year. This is their first year, and we really have to be really patient with them. But we are seeing that a lot more in classrooms, a lot more needs.
Stephen Barnett, what are you seeing and what does your research tell you about this idea of children having increased mental health issues, even children as young as preschool age?
We have been surveying a nationally representative sample of 1,000 families with 3 to 5 year olds who aren't yet in kindergarten. Their parent report of social emotional problems is twice the expected level. It went up dramatically during the pandemic, and it stayed up at all through the last year. There is some good news that children who are in preschool programs have lower levels of these problems, but they are widespread. They're in both problems of hyperactivity and conduct problems, but also on the side of not developing those peer skills of, you know, getting along, how to get along with other children and make friends. So young children are very stressed out and not doing well socially and emotionally.
Mai Miksic, how is Children First helping families navigate all of that?
Well, we are not a child-serving organization. We're a child advocacy organization, but we do have a helpline that we use to help families enroll in health care insurance. And, you know, through that, you know, helping families navigate getting to health care. But they can get, you know, behavioral and mental health services through that thing, yeah.
So it's at least helping to point them in the right
mm-hmm,
direction where
right.
they can get the services to
right.
help their children
mm-hmm.
through these things. We have a question here from Kurt who asks about property taxes. And Kurt says, homeowners in Pennsylvania and New Jersey pay some of the highest property taxes in the nation. A great percentage of these taxes goes to schools and other educational institutions. Can a greater percentage of these tax revenues be allocated to early child-related education agencies at the state and county distribution level? Or I guess put another way, can we allocate, Stephen Barnett, more money from property taxes to early childhood education?
We can. They don't necessarily have to come from property taxes. Our calculations are the Build Back Better by its last year would be providing almost $1.5 billion just for preschool to Pennsylvania, with a match from the state of not much more than $250 million. So that's a huge, the potential for this federal bill to take the pressure off of these state tax bases. In New Jersey, our preschool program is funded out of state general revenue, not the property tax. But if public schools move forward with early care and education, and they can do this bringing in private providers, so it does not mean because public schools are funding it that they have to be the ones delivering it, then you would expect some share of state revenue, local revenue, mostly from property taxes. I will say, though, that many communities in Pennsylvania with low-income families or and middle-income families, they have to be feeling tapped out on the property tax. So I think we need to think about broader solutions to this. There are broad state solutions as well as this federal solution of Build Back Better.
And Stephen, how many states already have universal pre-K thus far?
Every state in D.C. except for six. And those are mostly western rural states. The exception to that is New Hampshire.
And I was reading that it seems that Boston tends to do it particularly well. What are they doing right that perhaps can be emulated in other parts of the country?
Boston's been working very hard for decades at developing a high-quality preschool program. I will say it only serves about half the kids. Right? So the half that get it, that's great. They have very high standards for learning and teaching. It's connected to K-12. The instructional quality is very high. The supports for social and emotional development, very strong. It's very well funded. Teachers in these programs make the same kinds of salaries and benefits as K-12 teachers. That's a dramatic change, and it enables you to recruit and retain the kinds of high-quality teachers that are needed to deliver highly effective services.
Which leads,
and so as a result, you see randomized trials showing kids who are in this program, you know, almost 20 years ago, are making more money as adults, and of course, paying more taxes.
And it can be traced all the way back to early childhood education.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which leads to a question from Jean, who says, my daughter's class closed because of teacher shortages. Why is it now so hard to find qualified pre-K teachers? Is it just about salary? Damaris, what do you say?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not sure if it's just about salary. I do know that that is one of the main reasons. But you know, a lot of teachers have their own children too, and you know, children in school as well, and they also need to support their families. So to try to juggle that has been really, really difficult. You know, so they've made some decisions into not coming into work in the early childhood sector and take on other jobs. You know, just probably for the year or so. There's so many crossroads.
Yeah, we're seeing in just the K-12 world a teacher shortage.
Yeah.
So if you are adding to that the low salaries that early childhood educators are getting paid, it's not a surprise that we have such a big teacher shortage right now. And for teachers in pre-K counts with a bachelor's degree and certification, they can go to a public school and teach kindergarten. And not only will they have higher salaries, but they will have health benefits and retirement benefits, which often they can't get at a child care center.
And that's hugely important.
Yeah.
Damaris?
Yeah.
I agree with Mai. We've prepared our teachers, you know, with great salaries, not great salaries, you know, reasonable salaries, competitive salaries, and they go to the school district. How do we compete with the school district when they have a union, when they have, you know, great medical and benefits across board, right? In addition to that, a lot of staff are leaving to go to places like Amazon, you know, that is paying $21 an hour to start and like this ridiculous amount of money for bonuses. We just can't afford that. We can't afford it.
Stephen Barnett, how do we in the U.S. compare with other countries when it comes to the way that we do early childhood education?
We do not compare well. It used to be just continental Europe that did better than the United States. France, for example, universal preschool, very high quality, excellent programs long ago, and very strong supports for child care. And country after country, it's not just the Scandinavian countries. But now the UK, Ireland, Australia, all ahead of us, and increasingly countries you would not expect. If you live in Shanghai in China, your child can go to universal preschool with a teacher who has a four-year college degree. So the many countries have passed us by. When we get behind China in early childhood education, the U.S. and its future is in serious trouble.
My Sicknick, I want to ask you once again about the Build Back Better plan, which, as we have mentioned, is stalled in the Senate. And a large part of the reason for that is that Senator Joe Manchin wants more information on the long-term cost of the expanded child tax credit and how it will be paid for, because he's saying if it gets renewed next year, it'll probably be renewed for at least a decade. We need to understand what that's going to cost and how it's going to be paid for. Is that a fair concern, given the billions of dollars that we're talking about?
I mean, I can see where the concern's coming from in terms of the long-term costs, but we also have to think about the cost savings that we will get out of this. When we reduce poverty, we're talking about reduced health problems, reduced strain on our health system. We're talking about reduced rates of incarceration, and that's reduced costs in our criminal justice system. And so we really can't look at this from just a simple, like, well, what's it going to cost us out of pocket? There's a lot of opportunity here to improve our society at large. And so I feel like Mr. Manchin is a little narrow in his thinking here. Mm.
Stephen Barnett, another criticism about Build Back Better is that the plan is a one-size-fits-all. It doesn't take into account the needs of individual states. And there are some people in the child care world who feel like that money should be, you know, states should decide what they need to do with that money instead of it being a one-size-fits-all. Is that a fair criticism?
Not at all. I think that reflects widespread misunderstandings about the bill. The states remain firmly in charge. Of course, states don't even have to do it. Right? They could just say no, and everything would continue just the way it is, including in terms of federal child care subsidies. But if they say yes, then states develop their own plans. The first 3 years, states don't have to put up matching money. They don't put anything at risk. They develop their own plans for how to do this. There's substantial flexibility. Even on the pre-K side, the list of requirements that states have to put in place is very short. Maybe 10 things you could list on one piece of paper. It's not a federal takeover of anything. It's really remarkable in terms of the flexibility that it gives states. And many states wouldn't have to change anything. Pennsylvania would have to upgrade all its preschool programs to the level of pre-K counts. That's not a bad thing, and Pennsylvania's already said everyone under 300% of federal poverty level, which is a pretty high bar, is eligible. That it doesn't reach anything close to the eligible population currently. But in terms of what would Pennsylvania have to do anything, in some sense, nothing it's not already doing to do if they could find the funding.
We're going to have to stop there because we are just about out of time. My Mixic, Damaris Alvarado Rodriguez, Stephen Barnett, I just want to thank all of you for the work that you are doing for families, and thank you so much for your time and helping us understand the issues around childcare in America.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler are our producers. Charlie Kyer has been our engineer today. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Musk-Cohen.